to do is we got almost up to the takeover of 9 and the sit down at 4 last time. I wanted, there were a couple of things that I wanted to go over before we started on that. One was the children's picket line, which was posted earlier. Do you recall where you got the idea for it?
Where I got the idea for the children's picket line? The only thing that I know is that when I was in the YPSLs, Young People Socialist League, that we felt we were such a small force in such a large sea of people that we needed to have demonstrations besides just our little meetings and selling our paper. And one time we got the crazy, we were very young, you know, got the crazy idea that we would all dress up in the blue working man shirt, the red tie, and the navy brown skirts, and the navy blue skirts and pants for the boys, and attend some kind of a baseball game in a group, just to be seen and just to be seen together with this little uniform idea. Perhaps that's even where the idea of the beret and the armband came with the women, I don't know. But I knew that any kind of a visual demonstration that had appeal, and of course a lot of young people came over and wanted to know about this shirt and tie business when we were at the baseball game. We were trying to talk to other young kids about socialism. Perhaps, I think that was it. And I knew that children were suffering so much as a result of the conditions in Flint. They had no way to express themselves. And I thought children might just as well get out, even though it wouldn't be their words, the slogans on the signs. Nevertheless, they might just as well get out and demonstrate as the children of, you know, the people who were fighting to get a better standard of living.
The use of the children in Lawrence and then the
Patterson site too? If I was, I didn't know about it. If I had read it someplace, I even to this day, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I think it probably stemmed from, as a gypsum, knowing that bringing youth together very often attracted tension both from other youth and adults.
Was the idea really to capture the eyes of the media through that kind of demonstration?
Well, of course, we were trying to do that. We were talking up in the headquarters of the Penn Gallery building constantly, how can we break through the press outside of the Flint Journal, which was not giving us a good press, naturally. How could we get to the Detroit papers and that didn't feel the threat so immediately, because Flint was a General Motors company town, and to the other papers across the country to let the other unionists also know that we were doing our best to win the strike that had started in some of the other towns. And then also, I think that I felt that if anybody got it locally, through the Detroit papers, because the Detroit papers, of course, came into Flint. If anybody got it locally, I would like to appeal to women, you know, through their children. They knew their children also were suffering, and I think that was in the back of my head. But I know that we wanted to get, and it did make the press across the nation. And I even got some mail to me from Europe, some of these pictures of the little children. So we knew that it was a success. Now, unfortunately, events move so fast. All of this is compacted into 44 days. Events move so fast that we didn't have a chance to mobilize another children's picket line, or we had the idea of teenagers, high schoolers, and small younger groups of young people like that. And events move so fast, then it became, we were shown on the defensive in so many areas that it became necessary to go right over into getting the adults into activity, primarily the women.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just struck me in reading and listening to the tape that we've done last time. It didn't strike me when we talked about it, but it struck me listening to it. Well, I wonder if the idea came from Lawrence or from Patterson, who's more directly the youth children.
See, I didn't remember that. I don't even remember it to this day. But that's interesting. Women must think the same the world over, huh?
Well, in the case of the...
I told you, yes, that I followed, you know, examples laid down by other women thinkers, you know, in the past. But unfortunately, I don't think that... I don't even remember reading about it as you related again. But it's been so many years, perhaps I did know, perhaps unconsciously or something, but I think it was associated more with our attempting to have little demonstrations as yipsos, and then knowing that the children were suffering and that this would appeal to women generally. And men, father instinct, you know, it wasn't dead then at all. And men, parents. But our main aim then was to break through the Flint Journal and get something that would be a human interest story. Now, from the other group up there, that I think it was from the Communist Party group, they organized that veterans flag raising, veterans post of the UAW, and the flag raising ceremony previous to that. And that they thought that would have great appeal, the veterans saying, you know, that this was, that they had fought in a war for decent standard of living and so on. They had a good program worked up around it. But, of course, the children got much more publicity.
Now, did this, as a result of the publicity from the children's people, did that generally bring the women's activities into more light?
I think the women became more focus of attention. However, you know, this was a national strike, too. Remember that. And what was happening in Atlanta and some of the others, let's see, Atlanta, Georgia, and Fred Piper, I think, there, and a couple of the other places, was always reported along what was happening in Detroit, the efforts that they were making in Detroit. And then Flint became the focus a little bit later when they realized that this was the direct thrust on General Motors.
Did any of the others...
I know another reason. On the children, not to my knowledge. I never saw anything at all. No, I never saw anything. For one thing, we had to be very careful about what the journal would say. The journal also was picked up as the local paper by other parts of the nation. We had to be very careful because at that particular juncture, it was safe for children to be out there. But at most of the other times, we didn't feel it was safe to have children out there at all. And you couldn't be protecting children, which would be your first concern, and then your picket lines and your men in the plant, too. It was impossible. So that was another consideration. We were hoping that teenagers who would be able to run, you know, we would be able to work with them later, but didn't have time. Things moved too fast, yeah. And the women then were more important because they were the ones that the company was gunning for inside the home to break the strike. They weren't talking to the kids. They weren't the economic factors there that the women were.
I wanted to clarify one thing about the artillery when we talked last time. You couldn't recall when the idea arose and when the first meeting was. In the Fine book, he talks about the artillery growing out of a New Year's Eve dance outside. Do you recall anything about that?
I remember that Fisher One, but it really, I wasn't even at Fisher One at that dance. Where I was at Fisher Two, because that was the plant that needed the assistance. All concentration, you know, by Travis and Krause's work, Fisher One, where they had planned, I even noticed from the book, this had been planned from the beginning to focus in on that plant. There was a quote in there that they said to these workers, you are going to play a great historic role and you will go down as, well, I don't know, the people that have played the key role here. And it happened to be, this focus is thrown over to Chevrolet, but Fisher too needed the help, and I was on that picket line at the time, and the men were up on the second floor, and I remember the women coming down. No, at Fisher One, they were protected. They always had a picket line. They had a good spirit. The kitchen was right across the from the plant, so on. And nobody ever came and threatened, except if sickness occurred in the family and so on. But even then, they could get back in the plant. Fisher too, once they left, there was no way of getting past the guards down there. And the women came down, and said, here I am alone on New Year's Eve, no place to go, and so on and so forth. And if you're going to persist in this way, we're going to, you can, I'm just going to leave you, and we're going to get a divorce. And they did. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, divorces were started mm-hmm. by some of these women. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized the women could break the strike very easily from inside the home. Mm-hmm. And we actually saw, while we were on the picket line, a couple of the men that came down. They were probably threatened by what their wives had told them, didn't want their families broken up. And when they did, they looked like dogs with their tails between their legs. They hated to do it. And the men in the plant booed them vociferously. And that's when I got the idea. And, of course, I tried to talk to a couple of these women, but they were impossible. They were hysterical. And so I started talking to other women. There were a few of them that started coming around with their husbands. And I started talking to other women right then and there and said, we've got to get together. We've got to have some way of talking to these women. And we realized then that the problem was so many of them lived on the outskirts of town, and we'd have to get some kind of an organization and talk to their husbands about bringing them down.
So it sounds like there was a real separation between those who were picketing outside of 2 and those who were picketing outside of 1.
Well, no, there wasn't a real separation. The more glamorous action, of course, was outside of 1. And there were always more people there. The strike kitchen, there was more of an esprit de corps and a feeling of strength out there. So people who felt a little hesitant would rather go where there were more people and go over to the kitchen and get the feeling of comradeship and solidarity and so on. Or go up the Penn Gully building where there were mass meetings and assignments were given. It was a little harder picketing at Fisher 2.
How many of you, in those very early days, right after the Fisher 2, would be outside of 2 picketing before the battlefield run?
Before the Battle of Bull Run, how many were the picket line was, buried. There would be, during the night they had men with drums, these steel drums and fire and sitting. They would have assignments. They were called picket sentinels. In case any action was perpetrated against the men sitting down, they would immediately run for a phone and call for reinforcements, and we had people sleeping up in the Union headquarters in Penn Gully building. We had cars that were assigned to be kept there at all times to rush people out. And in the early wee mornings of the hours, the people wouldn't get down there. But usually, remember, men got up in Flint to start work at 6 o'clock in the morning. And usually starting early in the morning, they would have picket lines down there in pretty good force, because the men's habits of getting out of the house, they would go down there, and then they would go to the Union Hall for a little sustenance, a little moral build-up, and back again. And they would have assigned hours, and they would have assigned picket squads going out there every couple of 3 hours or so. There would be a car, the announcements would be made, cars now leaving for Fisher 1, cars now leaving for Fisher 2, or some other action. The group is going to another small factory that wanted to organize or something.
So until the battle was done, though, when you were on the picket line and not in the Pendale building, you were usually outside of Fisher 2 then?
Yes, I was. I wouldn't say I was usually out. I was usually, but I wasn't out there for a great length of time, because after New Year's Day, I began to realize that I had to be up at the Union Hall to contact women.
Now,
when we held the children's picket line, remember, we took that out at Fisher 1 because that was the big arena where it got more attention, and even the press gave more attention. And the press was directed by Henry Krause, always out there, because that was the more glamorous
right.
part of the strike. And it looked a lot bigger. It was a lot bigger,
mm-hmm.
the movement there.
Well, so would there be as many as 100 tickets there on the street?
Not always, no. There would be that many people in the vicinity, because they would be over in the strike kitchen eating, and groups coming and going into the headquarters and back. Yes, there would be at least 100 people in the vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
the picket line would sometimes be 100 on the picket line or 200. Other times there would be 20, 25, or again, during the night, you always had people over in the strike kitchen. You had your sentinels. And
now, when if you apparently were in the Pengelly building when the action started that led to the battlefields when the men went over.
Yes, I did go from, yeah, I think I did. Mm-hmm.
Now, were you anticipating at all that the company was going to cut off the food supply? Mm.
We knew that there might be an attack at any point, you know, but we didn't know when, where, what the excuse was going to be.
Well, up until that point, up until January 11th, do you recall any incidences on the picket line itself in terms of a hand-to-hand situation with either the company guards or people from the town who were basically supporting GM?
On the picture two picket line?
Mm-hmm.
Most of those incidences of hand-to-hand combat that would be that some stool pigeon would take a walk just long enough, and then they would go up into a beer garden. This is a habitat sometimes people would talk to other workers, take him up and talk to him to try to recruit him. And in the beer gardens, the stool pigeons like to operate, getting in on union conversations, reporting names, and so on, and sometimes provoking fights. And then they would waylay a guy to put the fear of God into him after he came off from a picket line. I think most of the action was there.
Mm-hmm. What, did you have questions then in terms of leaving the picket line in groups? Did you have to, or was it safe to leave individually, say, to return to the Pengelly building and return home, or did you always take those kinds of
things? No, but at one point, there was a guard assigned to me, and I'm a little bit hazy exactly which point it was. I know that it irked me a little bit, the inconvenience of feeling that somebody always had to be around. But that was after a verbal attack at a big meeting of the Workers' Alliance in the IMA auditorium one time. And the attacks on the union men were stepped up. And I was mentioned by name, and they felt that I was vulnerable then. And there were plenty of threats against the women when they started wearing the red berets outside of the strike area. Plenty of threats against them.
So that was after the brigade was formed then?
Yeah. The insignia gave the women, brought them into that area too.
Oh, because that was one of some of my questions related to what the response of the community was to the brigade. But before we get to that, do you recall then between the time of the battlefields run and the takeover at 4, were there incidents in that period then on the picket line where the women were engaged in fighting before the
Yes, there were. There were times when there would be a shoving and some of these things were done so professionally that after it was over, you could have interrogated people who were right there, and they didn't know how it happened. But they actually had jiu-jitsu people. That's what it was called then, instead of karate. And they were professionals, and they would come into a picket line or into a group, and before you knew it, some man, I don't think I remember a woman ever being flipped completely right on the breath knocked out of him, was lying flat, prone. And you looked around to see who did it. And, of course, there would be all kinds of accusations and hysteria, and emotions ran very high then because there were always threats and attacks, and the pitch of the whole town was very high. And sometimes the people would be to provoke fights amongst people who were together, the strikers themselves, yes, the picketers. That I remember, and I remember a number of times when police would shove. And one time we got in such an altercation, and I can't remember exactly where it was. It seemed like it was around the sound truck up on Kersley in the Chevrolet area. And we were in hand-to-hand combat with the police because I remember winding up with a whip and a badge in my hand. And that's all I remember. But we were in hand-to-hand combat then. And there were women involved in that. and one of them got her arm twisted very, very badly by a policeman. Both were involved. Both were involved. There weren't. I had a city police badge, I think. I think that was a city. Yes, I'm sure it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because then I think the city police wore blue uniforms, and the company guards, I think, wore gray. I don't remember exactly.
It was very different, it seems, from other organizing and labor situations where the conflict very often and the fighting very often, aside from the forces of football law and order of the city, were scams. In this case, you didn't have that kind of situation of people who basically, in this case, they weren't scams because people weren't going in. But who under other circumstances would have been those who were scabs, who were continually in altercations with the picketers. It sounds like a very different kind of construction to the thing than was usually the case in previous organizations.
Well, we called scabs and scissor builds people even when a plant was down who was carrying information back or joined the Workers' Alliance. We still called them scabbing on the workers' movement to build a union, whether they were in the plant or whether they were out of the plant. And some of them did play some very effective roles, but the ones who really started and provoked most of the situations were the paid people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to stick their neck out farther than the other scabs and scissor builds.
Who did you refer to as the scissor builds?
The workers who just were too dumb to know that the union was for their benefit, who thought that the General Motors was the great white father, who the hand that feeds them, and they go around, don't bite the hand that feeds you, you know. What would we do in this world without General Motors? Those were the scissor builds.
Where did the expression come from,
I think they were old wobbly expressions, if I'm not mistaken.
I've heard it in reference to AFL people. I'll have to check it.
It could have been used to some of the old AFL craft unionists, too. It was anybody who did not have the sense to understand that industrial unionism in a big corporation like that was the answer to the problem. The Wobblies had some of the most colorful language. And as I sit here trying to recall some of the terms that we used, picked up from them, so descriptive, so apt, I'm having difficulty. But we did use them. They were very colorful phrases.
Did it come as a result of, your study group
study
the Wobblies, or were there old Wobblies?
There were some old Wobblies involved, and there were some old anarchists, too. And while they didn't have they weren't in an organized group as such. You know, they had come from different parts of the country. For instance, I was just thinking about a man by the name of Clayton Carpenter, who was very active in the Fisher One situation. He was a PP member, and he was one of the really great guys out there in educating workers and building for both the first and the second strike. And there was a time in his life when he went as a hobo from one part of this country to the other. And when he spoke, he was very colorful in his language, and he told us about the Bindle Stiffs and their discussions in the jungles and things like that. And he was also an atheist that used to be quite a character. You know, people would say, well, this is against the order of God. There were a lot of religious people then coming out of the deep Bible Belt and into our old conservative church traditional city, too. And they would say, well, we don't know if this is God would condone this kind of thing, man fighting against man, and the corporation and is composed of human beings and so on. And he would say such shocking things. One time I remember, he even shocked me because I was afraid it would be picked up by the press. I must have been press conscious then. He said, do you want me to tell you something? If Jimmy Jesus came down here right here today, he said, and he started telling us, of preaching brother love again with some of these scabs and scissor bills here, he said, you know what I'd do? And the other guy said, no, what would you do? I'd grab him by his goddamn beard and say, you mean to say this is the kind of a world you and your dad created? And He was such a colorful figure. We had several of them interspersed, but they were so far advanced over the vast majority of the workers that they stood out. Their phrases were picked up, but sometimes they had to be kind of toned down a little, if it were possible to tone them down.
Well, was there a lot of internal conflict between, say, the very unsophisticated fundamentalist Southern workers and those of you who were much more sophisticated, wider read, had a socialist ideology? How did you relate with each other?
Well, we had to soft pedal, of course. Any terms like socialism or revolution or anything like that. And we had to just talk in economic terms, and the key term was speed up. And you could talk about the starvation of their kids. Their kids were damn hungry, you know. And about the medical bills and the lack of clothing, the lack of fuel in their homes. And so there was no conflict. There was no
very concrete terms. Yes.
And even in very immediate terms, it had to be. And even the GM propaganda was in the light of food sometimes. You are taking the food out of the mouths of your babies, and this appealed to the women, mm-hmm. you know, by striking. Mm-hmm. You're not helping the corporation. And they tried to get some little wage raises in various departments in a paternalistic way.
This is a review. If during that time, we did talk about the formation of the brigade and going to Saginaw last time, if during this time, between the formation of the brigade and the takeover of Four, do you recall any other actions of the brigade, specifically on the line, either at 2 or 1? Was there any time during this period before the takeover of Chevrolet when you actually did mobilize and lock arms? Or was that the first occasion?
No, there were. And I'm sorry, and I don't think it happened either at Fisher 1 or at Fisher 2. I think that it was in other areas, other small strikes.
Hmm.
I think at Standard Cotton there was some kind of a riot situation that took place where we actually did lock arms. There was more than one occasion, but now it's very hazy. And because of these other smaller groups coming in and joining, this big 156, number 156 was the local number, and a proceeding to organize, it was a very difficult period, you know. You couldn't let them down. And yet you didn't have the forces to keep, you know, to propagandize the workers of AC, please help us, please go on strike, and to try to get information into Buick and try to get them to, well, we knew that was a pretty difficult proposition because their conditions were nothing like the rest of the city. But to concentrate on the auto workers of the city, and then having the penny store, the Redmond workers, and the Standard Cotton, and my God, I can't. The transport workers were on strike, and very often they were beaten up, you know, and needed assistance.
Did the brigade ever become involved with the transport workers?
No, because the transport workers were usually at the Penn Gallery building operating right directly out of there. But they were caught, as leaders. Fred Stevens, the president of that, was a very outspoken man again, you know. And he got up and he addressed the auto workers and explained the tie-up between workers of the transport industry, which was a great help to us, and their strike was. And the tie-up between them and the other industries of the city and the support that we were getting from other workers not involved. The city itself was, 80% auto workers. And everything else was outside of that, but nevertheless, it was very important for the whole idea of the message of unionism to support whatever little group decided they wanted to sit down too and join 156. But of course, after they sat down, they required some help.
Now, were they, for instance, when you went to support of the penny strikers,
mm-hmm.
would they call the brigade in or call the union, or
yeah.
is this something that you would they would actually call for help.
Yes, yes. They were sitting down inside the penny store, and they would say some danger was threatening or something like that, and would we get send somebody down there right away? So it would go over the loudspeaker. If there wasn't a meeting where we could announce or can or make plans, automobiles leaving for penny store area. And always we needed manpower, and that's why we had the big mass meetings going all of the time, so that when the workers came down there, if there were no points of action that were they were needed on, we always tried to keep a reserve up there in having meetings, you know, big meetings, small meetings.
This was before the Chevrolet takeover,
wasn't
it?
Yeah.
Was it just the brigade that went down, or were there people putting the brigade?
At one point, the brigade was sent down only because they were women, and we were trying to, I don't know, I can't remember. There was some kind of an emergency down there one time when we thought the brigade going as its, you know, as an entity down there was a necessary thing. But now I'm getting into the dim gray areas of my brain. I really am.
Well, now, were the women sitting down inside a penny?
Mm-hmm.
And did they stay there for a while, or was it just a very short sit-down?
I can't recall the duration of that. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Because our main concern was, my main concern, too, was with the auto workers.
Well, you know,
everything would have gone under if we hadn't won the GM strike.
Can you capture at all what the feeling was in terms of, and here you have a city that, as you say, is 80% auto workers.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting a build up in the strike against GM, and all these other places are starting to go. In terms of your own ideology and the belief in a socialist revolution, how did you feel when all of this started happening? Did you feel that you were really close to a very basic change occurring, or did you think it was just the first step in terms of unions? Or did you see the possibility of something happening with all this build-up now?
Well, when it first happened, I know that I felt that industrial unionism would sweep the country. I was very idealistic, you know, it was going to be every great production. And then from there, we felt that the fraternity, and of course it was a different spirit then, brotherhood then meant something. It was a word that was so filled with meaning that the socialist and non-socialist alike, when we call somebody brother or sister, that meant we were locking arms, now we understand where our interests are, and we're going to fight for those who don't, who are weaker than we are. Don't have the same organization, unionization. And we felt that after all of the big industrial corporations were organized, that the strong would help the weak, and that then we would go into all industries, the farm workers, all of the small plants and small business enterprises, the office workers, help the weak, you know, workers to organize. And then that out of that we'd have some kind of voice in the running of the government, perhaps a labor party. I think that we didn't see immediately socialism, but we felt then with further education and up and up and up in the consciousness of the workers who created the wealth and so on, that ultimately we would have socialism. And I think then we really felt during the heat of that struggle we'd see socialism in our lifetimes.
Mm.
And we thought it would probably come through the vehicle of a labor party in America.
And so you still view it in terms of an electoral process, which in those days was still the thinking of the Socialist Party.
I think at that time we did, but we felt that it would move very, very rapidly now, because with the NRA, you know, you had so many big upheavals all over the country that it gave one hope that out of this would come a political movement. Mm-hmm. And later in Michigan, you know, we did form the the Canadian Commonwealth Federation, the Michigan Commonwealth Federation, which was comprised of Labor Party, union leadership, and it was a Labor Party in the state of Michigan. That was later.
That was right after the war.
Yeah, that was right after the war. So that was our concept, that that's the way that it would come. But I felt surely that I would see socialism in my lifetime at that period.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could have lived then, you know, you would have been filled with hope and optimism too.
That's what I was really curious about, was that trying to recapture what the feeling was, because it must have been tremendously exciting as you saw white panels go down and a little faster here and a little faster there, really thinking that you were on the brink of a change.
And people were learning, people who couldn't read and write, and people who could read and write a little, but they hadn't even been in the habit of reading the daily press. Maybe they couldn't afford it, or maybe they just weren't in the habit. We're learning so rapidly. For the first time in their lives, they became interested in what was happening in other states of the Union and what was happening abroad. And then we would make reference to what had happened in the history of America and the labor movement. And so many of them were just drinking it up and eating it up like they had been thirsty for such knowledge, such reaffirmation that laboring man was important, that we just thought this process would continue, you know, and it would only grow with more and more teachers going out from the ranks of labor. Yeah, we were pretty optimistic then and idealistic, and it was really quite a period.
With the influence of the wild and some of these old timers, the view was basically of organizing unions rather than the kind of syndicalist view of taking over production. There was never any push for that or any hope that that could be accomplished.
No, I don't think so. Not at that point. I don't recall of any. We had too many international factors that began to come in on our minds, too. I don't believe that was ever considered. It may have been by some people, but it surely wasn't discussed, and I don't think that we actively thought about it. We thought of controlling by the power of the union. We felt that with this first baby step of recognition, that more and more control would pass over to the union. But I don't think that at that point we thought of going in and taking over production. We thought, I think the electoral process probably.
What I'd like to do is throughout, then up to the time of the Chevrolet 9 and 4 takeover, the brigade would go to these other places and basically go be at both Fisher 1 and 2. At that point, you were then spending more time at Fisher 1 as well, not focusing just on 2 anymore.
We were sending out squads. Yeah, there would be a carload, and very often some of the brigadiers would go fill up a couple of cars. There'd be a couple of women go here, 3 or 4. And I think then we wanted to make sure that always these brigades, these red berets and armbands were in evidence wherever we could. That was part of the thing, too, to let them know that they could call and we would have some kind of an emergency mobilization and so on.
What was the attitude of the community towards the brigade?
You know, things stepped up very, very fast, but I just remember that the majority opinion was these very dangerous women, they must be all radicals, you know, that it was unheard of for a woman to go out with a weapon and to form in that kind of a military organization. The church, the ladies' aid societies of the churches and all of the decent women of town, of course, the hackles went up and down their spines, and they just couldn't conceive of a real lady, a woman of culture or anything like that, doing such a thing. And that was the prevalent note set by the radio and the press of Flint at the time. Other women felt a little bit threatened in their homes. They couldn't get out and do these things, and what the hell was going on anyway? But when they came down to the headquarters and they met some of the women who were just ordinary women like themselves and who by this time had had enough confidence in them, their own activities and their own role, met them, it changed their thinking considerably. But you must remember that even during the most hectic period, when we had the building just groaning with people coming up to this main headquarters, and the kitchens were full out of Fisher 1, even during that time, we were a minority of the population of Flint.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be very hard for us to gauge exactly what the sentiment was, because naturally the journal was the main spokesman and the radio, and they would quote all of the people against the union in their press and over the radio. And we had very difficult time trying to assess exactly what was going on outside the ranks. We just had to keep working and keep our sound card going. That was our main instrument of propaganda and instruction and information.
Was there actual editorializing against the brigade yourself?
Oh, I know there was it editorializing? I think there was an editorial too. Yes, of course. There was. And then they had a big interview with me one time, and they ran it in a most derogatory thing. They twisted the facts that I gave them, and they had they had a woman, a wife of a Buick worker, who had saved her money and who knew how beneficial it was to have General Motors in the town and all of the company propaganda. And she was taken with her hair done just perfectly in a lovely dress. And I was taken off activities out of the Pendelli building. And I was interviewed, it seemed like, in a restaurant or someplace. I think that we went out to have coffee with a reporter. And I noticed by this time that Krauss himself didn't want to let anybody handle the journal, because everything was always twisted and used against the union. So he passed this one over to me. He wasn't too fond of me anyway. And I was quite naive and quite honest with the guy. Now, when I reread it years after, it didn't seem quite so bad as I did at the time. But in juxtaposition to this woman all dressed up so lovely and so refined looking, and me taken right, you know, with my hair kind of straggly, right out of the union activities, and then he's twisting my remarks around and trying to use them against me and the union, that we didn't get much of a play in the press.